consumer, the consumers, well, we're living in an age of consumers, you know, point one is something I said Friday night to people in my shul at the Oneg. We don't realize, it doesn't hit us, that mass production of food is a recent phenomenon. And the need for hashgacha and heksha companies and very, very sophisticated mashgichim and hashgachas is necessary. And they say, well, what did they do in the past? In the past, you knew your local butcher and you grew your vegetables in the backyard and you made your bread. And now you go to the supermarket and you're buying something that's mass-produced, and the complexity of food production. And there got to be a misprint here. There's no way there's 800,000 chickens shechted a day. Rabbi Chiel, is that a misprint? I mean, just the mass production of a biscuit, of a cookie, with challah and yashan and chadar, it's just mind-boggling. And mass production means a lot of money is involved, and a lot of room for mistakes, and a lot of room for cutting corners. And who's minding the store if it's mass production? Who has control? So that's why it's necessary. But then there's not enough. And as Rabbi Stein said a year ago, we're starting from ground zero. You know, when Hashgacha started because of mass production, it was basar. And we're moving up in the world. Baruch Hashem, Hashgachas are maybe being more and more makpid. And Rabbi Yechiel is in the forefront, more than in the forefront, could be he's a lone voice, demanding transparency of the Hashgacha companies. What are your standards? Then we could look and see what we want our standards to be. And are you keeping to your standards? And they like to play their cards close to the chest. Some of it is because the consumer doesn't know anyway what the standards should be, but it just gives them more power if there's no transparency. And Rabbi Chiel's been campaigning and complaining, and he's come out a lone voice out there demanding transparency from the hashgachas. And what we learn tonight and in the coming weeks will, you know, there's an oilam here, and maybe it'll wake us up how important it is to have transparency, because look how complex everything is, and look how many different ways of doing different things there is. And a lot of times you're talking about kosher and not kosher, you know, so we want to know how do you deal with this problem, how do you deal with this issue. And Rabbi Chiel is maybe we can help him, and in the coming months maybe we'll all be inspired and galvanized into somehow something emerging from this, besides the unbelievable amount of knowledge that everyone will earn and learn, but also it'll galvanize us as consumers into demanding what's rightfully ours, because we're paying for the hashgachas. We know that. We go into a supermarket and we see what things cost, and some of that is the cost of hashgacha. It's a necessary cost, but let's get our money's worth and, as Rabbi Chiel says, demand transparency from the hashgacha companies. Enough talk from me. Rabbi Chiel, you should play it.
Good evening. As we start, it's already the second year, a lecture series of the Shovim, coinciding with the beginning of the Shovim this month, starting with Parsha Shemos. I want to just say a few things before we get going. First of all, tonight is not a one-time lecture, and we're not going to finish this topic tonight either, because it just takes longer. This is a class that I designed, which I started after Sukkot in my home. A bunch of community residents come, and because that's the Olam over there, it was typed in modern Hebrew transliteration as opposed to what we're accustomed to in this shul. So instead of Kashrus, it's Kashrut, etc., etc. I wasn't retyping it, so those that feel a little have to figure what the word out is, you'll get over it. Although my website has been inactive and the email, but I still have been doing work in different ways, this has been a big part of it. Rabbi Malinowitz actually is, in his way, has shown me, at least that's what I've received from a lot of his guidance, is that education is the way to go in this community. Has really been an example, because things have changed, because the consumer knows more and empowered and have made demands of stores, and as a result, the kashrus, I think, in Olam Beit Shemesh has changed for the better. Hopefully there is where to go, and hopefully things will continue in that direction. My goal has never been to persuade anyone to eat one heksher over another, although I have my own bias, and it is evident at times in what I write and what I put out there, either vocally or in paper. But my goal is education. I think the more we know of practical halacha, as I call it, of halacha l'maisa, what goes on in the streets and what goes on in the heksherim, we can, together with whoever it is we consult with, whether it's a rav, a husband with a wife, wife with a husband, whoever it is, make a decision of what we do and don't eat. As I've said over and over, ultimately we're our own mashgiach, we're the last person to decide what goes in our mouth, and it's our job to decide that whatever the food may be, that it's in line with our level. In order to make such a decision, we have to know basics to know what our level is. That's a starting point. So let me start with a few concepts, which I don't think I did last year, and I've spoken about it in the schools. I think it's important. The most common email, telephone call, communication I get is people ask me, is so-and-so a good heksher? Okay, I don't answer those questions anymore. I really always try to avoid them because I don't think it's my place. There are too many determining factors to decide if someone can eat a heksher or not. Most of all, you have to be a rav. I'm not a rav, and I don't paskin lo b'issur lo b'heter. That's not my job. If something is a scam, I'll tell you it's a bogus heksher. But other than that, there are differences in the so-called bedatzim. There are differences in the rabbaniyot where there shouldn't be, but the different cities, some are better at their job, some are not as good as the others. The point is, a good heksher, as I defined it, and when you'll read it and when you'll hear me say it, is a good heksher to me is whatever that hashkacha says they do, they do. And if they say that they adhere to A, B, and C, and these are the chumrot, these are the kulas, this is what they're stringent on, this is what they're lenient on, and they do that, that's a good heksher. And a good heksher does not necessarily have to be one that's acceptable to you, and there's no stira, there's no contradiction. Okay, and I think we need, it's very important to say, if I eat something and someone else eats a different heksher I don't eat, it's not kosher and treif. It's a difference of, I may have different chumras, different hidurim, different things I insist on, the other person doesn't, and that's, the word treif doesn't get used too often. There's a place for that as well, but there's a difference between deciding what works for you and running around. You know, I had a Rebbe always used to say, let's build ourselves up by our own midos, our own chinuch, and what we do, and not by putting people around us down. That's not the way we build ourselves up. So I think, by definition, when at least when I say good heksher, that means the heksher does what it says it's going to do. The next question would be, is the heksher suitable for me? And hopefully tonight, we start off the series. The biggest question everyone should have tonight is, why are we on chapter 4? What happened to 1, 2, and 3? The answer is because we're going in a different order than I do in my home for various reasons, and rather than change around the pagination, one chapter 4, so we made progress. And Yetz Hashem will do 1, 2, and 3, and also those that follow chapter 4. The idea is to build conceptually, the idea is to understand basics. The chicken, the Rav felt, and I agree, and others agreed, at least in the, I hate the terms, but in the Haredi school, or whatever you want to call this place, I don't know what we call it, but the thing with chickens and what shechitas you eat and don't eat, that sort of replaced in shul what in America people used to talk about, what the baseball scores were. Here in shul they talk about which shechita you can and can't eat. That sort of replacement. And I feel, at least from my limited knowledge, most of us know close to zero about what we're talking about, other than this is what this guy buys, or I saw someone buy, well, my rav, if your rav says it's good, mamela, that's something to be so mechan. This is my rav, I do what he says, but halavai we went that far. So there are considerations, and I've seen from the rabbanim who teach me, they say, even when they paskin, there's considerations. Some of the considerations are the level of a particular person, where he's holding, if it's a baal tshuva or not a baal tshuva, and the financial situation, what they can afford, and shalom bayis is a biggie. These are all things, that's why when people ask me, I tell them, I don't know you from anywhere, I can't tell you anything, it's not my job, you have to speak to your rabbi. Okay, so that's as far as terminology. Good heksher, also bad heksher. Bad heksher I usually save for, well, bad heksher is one who says it does A, B, and C, but they don't. And then there's a bogus heksher, which is like Badat Shropshitz, which is very popular in Yerushalayim. Baruch Hashem, it doesn't appear to have infiltrated Beit Shemesh yet. But if you looked at my website ever, and you see there's little clicks on the side of authorized heksher and non-authorized. And I'll remind you, when I say authorized, not authorized, that's by the definition of the chief rabbinate of Israel, not by Yechiel Spira. But that's Rupshitz, though, I've done a lot of checking into how it came about. Now's not the forum for it. Basically, it's a money-making. It's one of these Hashem that are out there that someone comes around every few months, collects a check, puts up a magnificent sign that many people rely on, and they sit down and eat thinking they're getting you know, the leftovers from the Kohen Gadol, when in actuality they're not getting anything that represents what's Mahadran Kashrus today. Okay, we'll get going. We're sort of going to read this as we go along, and I think I envisioned we'll do a little reading, explaining, show part of the PowerPoint. I'm not really sure. This is what you call off the cuff, but we're going to see where it goes. Well, okay, we'll get this going. We'll be a start. My goal here is, like I said, education, to become familiar with what's out there, and that's a starting point. My first question, does anyone know Cafe Ramon in Yerushalayim? Heard of it? Has anyone eaten there? Has anyone eaten in the last month? 2 weeks? 1 week? Nothing bad. I'm asking this. Everyone's nervous. Oh, he's going to come with the bomb. So people have eaten there. It's a well-known place. That's why I chose this place. That's dumb. And it's a place that a lot of former Americans eat at. And when the visitors come, that's like all of the regular. You go to the Kotel and you go to Cafe Ramon. So if anyone has eaten there in the last 2 or 3 weeks, so
it's over 50 years old.
Right. It's also listed as one of the 10 most successful restaurants in the state of Israel. No, this is the one on off of Ben Yehuda and Chov Lunds. So people frequent it, people eat by it. Does anyone here know what the Hekshev is on the meat side? Anyone know what the Hekshev is on the dairy side? Anybody know what the Hekshev is on the Mamilla Mall one? Okay. Basically, the silence makes my point. Most of us, we eat out because everyone goes there and everyone knows it's good and everyone goes. And Dafka, this is a good example because it is a legitimate place and it's changed their shame over the last year and a half about 4 times. So just to bring you all up to date, the one in Mamilla, which is dairy, the one on Lund Street, the dairy side, and the one Lund Street, the meat side, which is, this is the photo, of all Rabbinate, Jerusalem Rabbinate Mahadran. Okay, and for all those that are going to go home wondering, it used to be Agudas Yisrael, it used to be OU, it used to be Chassam Sofer Petach Tikva. The boss on his own, he wasn't thrown out, he didn't commit any crimes, he didn't get in trouble. He decided to give them more love because he came to the realization, no one looks, no one cares, why waste the money? And he's right. And not only that, if you've eaten there in the past, you may remember when you walk in, outside on the wall, near the entrances to either side, the respective sides, the dairy or meat, he had the two dot kashrus framed in a glass frame with a, and you could see what it was. They're not there anymore either. Bottom line is, he didn't have to have any hechsher, people would eat there too. So that's the point. It's sad, but it's true. And he's the best proof. This restaurant, while people on the mall are looking for business, over here in the pouring rain, people will stand outside in line waiting to get in. And I've stopped people on line because, you know me, I'm chutzpahdig enough, and I said, excuse me, I want to eat here. Do you know what hechsher it is? No one knows. But everyone goes to the mall and they can eat there. So that's the point. Everyone does it. It's probably the greatest pitfall for anything we may do wrong, sometimes right. But everyone goes there just means everyone doesn't know what everyone is doing. And it's never everyone, because I know people that don't eat there, so it's never everyone. But it's a lot of people. So the idea is the fact that, oh yeah, they ate there last week. Okay, I guess if it's the Rav Yishul, he ate there, that's a pretty good thing. But you need to ask. We perpetuate this, everyone goes there, no one really knows what we're doing. So Cafe Ramon is an example. A year and a half ago, it was Badatz Agudas Yisrael, and the dairy side was a different Badatz and Rabbanut Mahadran. Today is only Rabbanut Mahadran. If it works for you, fine. If it doesn't, doesn't. The point is not to put a blemish on Rabbanut Yerushalayim, but the point is to show things change. I've always said the Hashgacha is here for whatever reason. From what I remember in my old life in America, the Hashgacha used to be a little more steady. They didn't change weekly. Here they change quite a bit for different reasons. And this is a prime example. Okay, look at what you buy. Read the labels. This is the best example I could find. So here we have Shchitas Beis Yosef. Over here we have pork stew, bone, something or other. It's a real label. I didn't make it up. This was from a place in the United States, but I've seen pretty bizarre things in Eretz Yisrael too. Don't just grab it. It says the word Beit Yosef is the one that's probably the most used and abused in the meat industry. And as soon as people see the words, they're already picking up the package after they see that the price works. Look at what you're buying, read the label. If you're not sure, ask, don't be embarrassed. This is a pretty bad thing to bring home. I don't care whose hechsher it is. Okay. I don't know if we start here, let's see. I'm going to read sort of a paragraph at a time to myself.
Does Rabbanut Mahadran live live up to what it says.
We'll get into everything. I know everyone likes the dirt, but you got to come and stay a while until you get to the dirt. There's no fasting. The dirt comes at the end. That's how we keep you coming back. I don't know, they're all gone? Are we? I don't know. Are you? Gone. If you've registered and you've given an email address, you will also be getting a copy in your email inbox. Check. I would also like to repeat a conceptual idea. Last year you heard it for those that were here for the lecture from Rabbi Mordechai Kuba, who is really one of the experts in kashrus. He's been doing it for decades, and he's out there really, he's out in Japan and elsewhere. And that's been my yeshua since then, is basically the third party auditing. I mean, I've always said it, but he says it eloquently, so now I get to use his terminology. And as the Rav touched on before, if you buy a car, you can buy a consumer magazine, you can buy a Better Business magazine, if you buy a sewing machine, you buy almost anything, you look for a Tough Tekken in Israel or in America, the Underwriter Laboratory. You know that it meets a minimum standard, you have an idea what's going on, there's a place to check things out. There are comparison charts on the internet, and that's the way it should be. It's sort of a consumer protection idea, so we have some kind of an idea. If I want to buy a Ford, I want to buy a Chevy, what do I get for my money? How large is the gas tank? And we expect this, and we insist on it pretty much in all the things that we buy. You're going to buy a new third generation phone, you have to compare HTC to Samsung to whatever's out there. Comes to kashrus, we walk around like see no evil, hear no evil, the three monkeys, and everyone's going shopping, filling the cart, and we don't have a clue what we're doing. The hashgachas are taking good money for what they do, and they're entitled to it if they do their job. We're paying a lot of extra money for kosher. What that means, we don't really know. Hopefully we're going to learn a little about it in the next few weeks. And no one's holding anybody accountable. And that's why I'm not a popular person with any of these guys anymore, because even when I write good things, each one's waiting to know when they're the next guy who's going to be on the chopping block on the next report. And the truth of the matter is, in my opinion, it's a busha. Not because they're getting away with it, because we're permitting them as consumers to get away with it. And it's time that we start making demands. And if you know a restaurant, walk into a restaurant. Whenever you go, just ask, is the mashgiach here? You know, after the fourth time he heard no, he's going to Kupat Chalim, tell him to get a healthy mashgiach, or realize that someone's pulling the wool over your eyes. But it's time that these guys do their jobs. It's time that you have to know what to expect. And it's time to start building, raising the level of kashrus by using consumer power, which we have. We know these things from North America. That's the way America operates. And yet we come to Eretz Yisrael, don't worry, it's badatz. You know, I'm like, there are no words left for the amount of edge you see. Whether it's the Ramat Beit Shemesh list for the cottage industries, the Hanof list for the cottage industries, the restaurants and the ads in the papers, I call Motzrei Badatz. Wonderful. Which Badatz? Is there a difference between them? I don't know. What's the names of the different ones? I don't know. You know what I'm saying? It's absurd. And assuming they bring the highest level Badatz kosher to a store, which is a good starting point, who's the cook? Who lights the gas? What other ingredients are going in? Who's serving? Who's pouring the wine? Does anyone know anything? Is there a guy alive in the store that has an education from yeshiva that knows what Yovadeya looks like? And I'm not talking about chumras. If you come to my classes, you hear people that have heard me lecture over the years, we have enough trouble, you know, just complying with Shulchan Aruch. The other day, straightforward. Yes, there are places where there's differences of opinion, but the bottom line is we don't need chumras. The idea is that we're seeking basic compliance, and hopefully this will be another step towards getting us here. I start off this sheet with the general overview. Okay, I'm dividing for the sake of normalcy, because there's no end. I'm dividing the chickens into two categories. One is Rabbanut and one is Badatz. And we will get to different names and why, who's what, who's how do you know which is which. There are differences between the Rabbaniyot and there's differences in the Badatz, and they're all not created equal. But the point is that they all conform to the basic methodology of the Badatzim or the Rabbanut, meaning there's certain basics that categorize a chicken as a Badatz versus certain ones that categorize it as a Rabbanut. You can decide one is better, the other one's no good, we can decide one is great, why do I need the other one, it's a waste of money. At the end of the day, that's your decision. But the point is, I'd like to show the differences because there are many. According to some Rabbanim, they're not chumers, they're essential. According to other Rabbanim, it's needless chumers that in fact complicate kashering chickens. And at least let's get an education to decide what works for me, what should I pay extra money for, what is a waste of money, and what looks good, what doesn't. Okay, I write on the first page, the second paragraph, that once upon a time the chickens were raised, you know, for a few weeks till they got slaughtered. Now it's Emory Express. What they do today is the chickens are fed different diets. The idea is to get them as fat as they can, as fast as they can, get them to slaughter weight. And next thing you know, the knife is out and you see them in your local refrigerator. All right, what's the point? You know, you have basically, whether it's the kashrus people involved in the operation, whether it's the health people involved in the operation, what those two agencies have in common is that they're fighting the guy who's supervising the operation, and he has only one thing on his mind: profit margin. And profit margin means speed, moving the product along, getting out to the marketplace and getting done. So when the veterinarian comes and he wants to check what he needs to check, and the Rav comes and he wants to check what he wants to get, this guy just wants to get done and let me bring the chickens to market, let the shulchan do his deal, stop kvetching about the knife and stop kvetching about too fast, too slow, let's get him to the packaging room and be done. And that's reality. Some place it's a bit obviously exaggerated to the point to make the point, but that's the mitzvah, that's the reality of what exists. They have different goals. One person's there for, you know, they're there for different reasons. At the end of it, they're supposed to bring us a kosher product that meets the standard that they claim to meet. Okay, I started with the cages on page 2, because that was a bone of contention by the Rabbanim for many years, that the cages opened the way they opened, and they used to just literally opened it, dumped the chickens out, and they said that compromised some of the chickens perhaps, you could have fractures, dislocations. If a chicken's not capable of walking Dalet Amos before Shechita, it's not ra'oi to be shechted. Alright, so one of the changes a few years ago is they designed a new cage now so they can take them out and sort of throw them on the floor, but they don't. It's something they did. There was a lot of yelling going on. They spoke to like a Rabbi Zavitsky from B'nai Brak, for those that know of him, he's really an expert. And there was a lot of push to get a higher cage, a better cage, that the chickens, not because they're that humanitarian, because they're trying to limit damage to chickens to come up with halachic questions. The end of the day, as I write in here, is they measured the overpass on the highway, how many rows of chickens you can get on a truck. Making it any higher means you'd have to take a row off the truck, which means less chickens being transported. Not happening. So they went to Weizmann Institute in Rehovot and all the guys that deal with the genes and whatnot, and they developed a chicken with a shorter leg somehow. I don't begin to understand it, but this is working on, according to Rabbi Zavitsky. It's a hard one for me to understand, but they said over years they've modified the growth of the chicken. The bottom line is the chicken goes to slaughter at a much younger age than it used to. The problem, and this is, we're going to get into the beginning of the main problem. You've heard the term, perhaps, Tzomet Agidim. That's the intersection, I call it, on the drumstick where the 16 tendons of the chicken run through. Okay? There are Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael, we'll call them the Badatz guys. They feel for various reasons, primarily that the chickens are killed at a younger weight, at a younger age, and they've been fed so rapidly that while they have the body mass has the weight that they need to be slaughtered, but the skeletal system is not developed commensurate to the weight, and because of harsh conditions in Israel today, they don't walk around and develop muscles and tendons the way they should. So these 16 tendons are more prone to something happening, whether being damaged, basically one of them being torn or messed up enough that it's not kosher. The Shulchan Aruch tells us if any of these 16 tendons are torn, the chicken's treif. So over the years, and this goes back a while, the Rabbanim decided here that they're going to do a new inspection called Tzomet Agidim, which explains, for those that don't know why, certain brand chickens, when you bring it home, the drumstick has a big gash in it. It's not that nice polka that we were accustomed to as children. The other Rabbanim, we'll call them the Rabbanut, by and large feel the Shulchan Aruch makes no such demand. You don't have to cut open a chicken and start feeling the tendons and pulling on them and yanking at them. And so we're not looking for more work, we're not looking to increase the cost factor to the customer, we're not looking for things we don't have to look for, it's not necessary. Okay, for an example, Rav Belsky, who's one of the, Rav Yisrael Levi Belsky Shliti, he's one of the poskim for the OU, he's the Rosh Shiva of Tov Adas, in his tshuva he writes, for example, this, I know this is all starting to sound weird, but as the film goes and we'll start doing a little everything. It'll start coming together, hopefully. I just want to give some introduction. He feels, for example, that not only does one not have to cut open the drumstick and check the Tzomet Agidim, but by doing so, you've complicated things because once you've made a slice, now there's more area exposed to the outside. So when you salt the chicken, inside that cut, you now have to make sure you get salt inside. He said that Tzomet Agidim is a chumma, but if you don't get the salt inside, that the chicken wasn't salted, it wasn't kosher. That's much more serious than worrying about the tendons, which he feels you don't have to worry about. I'm trying to show you the two sides, okay? There's always two sides to it. In Eretz Yisrael, they discard that totally, and they say because the Me'udah Metzoy, the average chicken, the amount of chickens they found with problems with these tendons has reached the point where halachically demands a check, and external palpation is no longer satisfactory, but it demands actually opening it and pulling to see if that 16 are intact, and they discard anyone that tries to say otherwise. So that's really the two big difference. That's the two camps as far as Rabbanut and Badatz. In the United States, actually, like in Kiryas Yoel, which is a Satma community, and some of the other Hasidish Shechitas, they've also started with the Tzomet Agidim, and they feel, for whatever reason, I'm not up enough on the Shechita there to get into it, but they feel this is something that has to be done as well. Okay, Shulchan Aruch. Depends who you ask. That's why I didn't answer it. The Rabbanut says it's under Me'udah Metzoy, like it's 2-3%, and the Badatzim will tell you it could be 6, 7, 8, which demands checking. Even though Me'udah Metzoy, we know, is, at least in Shulchan Aruch, there's a lot of conflict, but the Poskim argue about that also. But if you're already up to 7-8%, I think Kula Amalo Pligate would say you need to check. All right. What they maintain is, for example, like the OU, for example, will you know, they do sample testing when the birds come in before they start doing a run, and they will determine the Me'udah Metzoy of the run. If it's too high, they'll send it back. If it's what they normally are accustomed to, they say now you don't need to check. Everyone has their way of dealing with it. The actual number, look, the last place I was at, they told me it's probably in the area of 6-8. If you want an actual number, which is pretty up there. All right, and it doesn't mean 6-8 of them you're going to see a torn tendon. It means 6-8 has enough of a suffix. Either something's inflamed enough or problematic enough, they're not sure enough. You'll see in the films, they don't spend a lot of time sitting there looking at it and pulling out new magnifying glasses. This is a several seconds, like a 3-second inspection. It's either good or it could be, you know, you're not sure. If it's for sure puzzle, the chicken's thrown into the line, it's marked trafe, that's the end of it. But anything that's questionable goes to a different line. They just don't deal with it. It's not time worthy. It's too expensive. It also stops the whole line. Okay? The whole thing with the Mahadran in general, you go around town, we all look, we eat Mahadran. To clarify things, someone asked before, Rabbi Orbach, there's Rabbi Orbach, just to name some of the Talmidei Chachamim that represent the Rabbanut Shechita. There's Rabbi Orbach, who's the Av Beis Din of Tveria. There's Rav Tzfanya Drori, the Rav of Kiryat Shmona. There's Rav Yaakov Ariel from Adgan. There's Rav Shlush from Haifa. There are many Rabbanim. Rabbi Orbach's more than most for reasons that aren't relevant. Like they don't call his Tiberian chickens, or they call this Rav Orbach. The rest of them they'll say Rabbanut Mahadran. Okay, according to the Rabbanut, that's the chief rabbin's decision, all the chickens they checked, all the chickens you find in stores are Mahadran. Okay, according to the Badatzim, all the chickens they have are Glot. Okay, as far as I'm able to see, and there's a lot of people here that are far more learned than me, please correct me. I don't know if the word Mahadran or Glot being associated with chickens anywhere. Glot has to do with the behemoth, the lungs, with tzichos, with lesions on lungs. It's now become part of the lexicon in the poultry industry. And Mahadran, last time I saw it was a few weeks ago when we talked about Mahadran and Mahadran for Neros Chanukah, for lighting Chanukah candles. Nonetheless, in the 21st century kashrus world, Mahadran, at least in Eretz Yisrael, has become a word, and it's a buzzword. All right, when you hear Mahadran, as I write, it leads one to believe that it's in a higher level. It's not the bare minimum. If there's places where you could be a little extra careful, they'll be extra careful. If the ingredients could have a little better heksha, they'll have a little better heksha. What does that all mean? It's very vague because everybody wants it to be vague, but they get more money for it. And the word Mahadran instills confidence, so you put Mahadran on the sign, and you're in business, everyone's shopping. Okay, I will tell you, according to the Kashrus Law of Eretz Yisrael, which is pretty old, the last update I think was in the 1980s. According to Rabbi Rafi Yochai, you've heard me mention his name many times, he's the head of the Machleket Honaat Kashrut. He's the Kashrut Enforcement Division. If a store or company writes the word kosher on a product, it has to have the approval of the chief rabbin of Israel. Okay, it doesn't matter if you hold by the rabbinate, you don't have, that's the state law. If they write blat, if they write mahadrin, if they write all kinds of other words, you can do whatever you want. I can show you places in the shuk, they blat kosher, don't have a two-dot kashrut, and no one can do a thing against them because they're not violating the law. And they're starting to figure these things out, unfortunately, and it's getting more difficult, not less. So terminology is important. To me, mahadrin, Beis Yosef, whatever it is, Rav Orbach, you need to know what the Ashkoch is, bottom line. The rest of it's the buzzwords, the advertisement campaign, all right? The store says mahadrin, that's nice, what's the tuda? And we have pictures of the Lubavitcher Rebbe on the wall and Rav Kaduri, that's wonderful, what's the tuda? You know, last year I told you the story, for those that are new, I'll tell it again. We went into the one pizza shop and the young guy behind the counter, I asked him, what's the heksher here? Alti dag. When someone tells me don't worry, worry. So I asked him, push it, what's the heksher? Ah, don't worry, look, and he showed me the picture of Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Kaduri, they were both there. So I said, what's the heksher? And he said, look at the pictures here. So I said, if they were serving me and your picture was on the wall, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But since that's not the case, what's the heksher? And he said, Slicha in Lanu, we don't have a heksher. That was the end of it. I was polite and I said, goodbye, have a nice day. So you get defensive, you get confused. For some people, Hebrew is still difficult. You need to look, you need to see the signs. The same thing as when a policeman stops you, it's the one Motzei Shabbos, you ran out of the house, your kid fell, you had to run to the emergency room, God forbid. You forgot your wallet, the cop stops you, no license. No, I've been driving for 30 years. The whole story, that's nice, you're getting a summons. You don't have the license, you don't have the piece of paper, you're getting a ticket. Same with kashrus. If you don't see a tuda, you shouldn't be buying something. You shouldn't be eating somewhere. These are the basics. The word mahadrin basically is affiliated with the rabbanut, so now we have the rabbanut side is some of the gidim not necessary, called mahadrin. The badat side is some of the gidim inspection is necessary, and they call them glot. Because once the rabbanut started using mahadrin, they had to come up with another word that was a one upward. So they used glot. All right, basically glot, for those who don't know, glot is basically means smooth. In Hebrew, they use the word chalak more often, but it's the same thing. Okay, the badat's chickens will also do an inspection of the lung. Once again, they have their reasons. They say certain times of the year, the lungs are more problematic, depends on weather, conditions, etc., etc. There's nothing in Shulchan Aruch that I'm aware of that says you have to inspect the lung of a chicken. I've been in Shechita houses, they've showed me, I've seen lungs that they tell me these puzzle the chickens. I'm not a mumcha enough to say yes or no, but I see a lot of chickens getting thrown around. They say you have to do it. They accomplish this by cutting open the chicken. That's why when you see a Rabbanut chicken, a Rav Orbach, a Rav Shlush, a Rav Drori, the chickens are nice, they're at rest, they're closed, the drumsticks were not hacked to death. It looks like something you want to stuff and eat. The Badat chickens look like they ran for their life and lost. That's the truth. Nothing you can do about it. They're cut open. The backs are cut open. The drumsticks are slashed. And they do take a beating. And often the parts are still somewhat connected by skin, but there's not much else holding them together. That's because of a lot of the inspections that they go through. The Tov Olara. So those who feel it's necessary, endure it. Those that feel it's not necessary, say, you're out of your mind. Okay, and was it? Okay, we got through that. Okay, this is just to show you some of the brands that are going around. Most of the Badatz brands today use holograms, some don't. I know I'm telling you this as a public service, not to make fun of anyone, because I know a lot of people here do use fly chickens. So I asked them, because I've noticed sometimes they have holograms, sometimes they don't. Like here we have some with. So I asked, what's the difference? How do you know? Because I'm always looking at from the consumer Ford end, what to be worried about. If I don't see a hologram, call them up, someone's faking the chickens. And they said, nah, we use them sometimes, sometimes we don't. Depends if the guy's around, it means nothing. So I said, why do you use them? Makes people feel better. So in case of Fleisch, it means that it's either there or not to worry. In case of all the other brands that are up here, they all told me if there's no hologram, don't buy it. That means someone's defrauding you and it's a fake, don't buy it. Or if the guy forgot to put it on in the packing house, but you have to assume it's not good, you shouldn't buy it. Okay. So we did the boxes. We got through that. Okay. Let's see. This is going to be hard interfacing. I have Yerushalayim only because it's a nicer color, but I want to make a point here as well. I have to say, I've been through Beit Shemesh now for 2.5 years. As far as Rabbanuts go, I think the Rabbanut here is marvelous. Rabbi Shlomo Switzer, Shlita, who runs Rabbanut, is a straight shooter. He's out there. He knows what he's doing. He cares. my own opinion, and I have a right to state my opinion, and I tell this to everyone wherever I speak, for anyone that would even bother coming to a lecture like this, to eat regular rabanut is a non-starter. It's a good heksher if you're in a city like Ramat Beit Shemesh, but it's not suitable for you. Those that disagree, eat it. Rabanut Mahadran, for example, and we'll get into some of the what and why, that's the other lectures. The point is, that's an example for me in my mind, in my life. Regular rabanut is a heksher for amcha. It's supposed to be minimal kashrus. So what do you mean minimal? Either it's kosher or it's not, but that's not true. Yes, the shechita has to be kosher, things have to be kosher, but from there to preparing food in the restaurant and serving it, there's a long road of places you can go left to right, kula chumra, and what you do. But Beit Shemesh, Baruch Hashem, is a good rabanut. Rabanut Yerushalayim, and for those that are recording it, make sure it's clear, is abhorrent. It's disgusting. You shouldn't eat the regular, you shouldn't eat the mahadran. And that is Yechiel Spear's opinion. The level of kashrus in Yerushalayim has reached a despicable level. The mahadran restaurants, unless you know the mashgiach, unless you know who's feeding you, unless you know what you're doing there, is bitachat kol bikoret, as you say in Hebrew. Alright, and that goes for examples of pictures that I brought to them of non-religious people pouring non-mevushel wine, non-gush katif greens being served to guests, rice not being checked, little things like that. These are all their vices. This is, well, not the wine, but... So Yerushalayim, by and large, is not the beautiful picture everyone thinks it is. For some reason, people assume you come to Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim is as mahadran as it goes. Halavai Yerushalayim one day. Maybe they'll have chief rabbinate, you know, elections coming up soon, and maybe Bezrat Hashem, it will be, you know, it'll go back up to what it was 25 years ago. Right now, by and large, again, there's a lot of mashkichim do a tremendous job. My opinion is, the mi'ut amatzoy of the places that are alaponim, that are really bad, has reached the level, unless you know the mashkich is, you should really think about going into the place, unless they have another heksher which you trust. All right, there's a cafe in Katamon, where the Arab comes in the morning, lights the gas, so it's Bishul Akum Mahadran for Ashkenazim and Sephardim. The owner brings the cake from my house, they ask the Mashgiach, do you know that she brings cake from my house? He goes, yeah, sure, she bakes it home all the time, it's convenient for her. Doesn't that bother you? No. Little things like this. It's pretty bad, it really is, not a joke. Mirz Hashem will go up. The point of this, though, is, you look at this little thing, Baso Tachun Rak Ayidei Mashgiach B'Mokom. So I've seen that. I never really thought what it meant. I know what I thought it meant, so I went to the rabbi and asked. So they explained to me, because once meat is ground, it has no more simenei kashrut. So they feel if you want to have ground beef in Yerushalayim with a hashkacha, either you have to see the mashgiach take a piece of meat that has a simen kashrut and grind it before you, like some of the supermarkets here do. They throw it in the grinder while you're there. Or it has to be done before you get there and put into a bag with a little slip, you know, signed John Hancock Mashgiach, closed and sealed properly according to halacha, and you have a bag of chopped meat with hashkacha. So I said, but all the butcher shops in the shuk, for example, they just have these large stainless steel vats of chopped meat piled high, looking nice. What's with that? They said, it's very nice, but it has no hashkacha as far as we're concerned. So we buy that chopped meat, it has no heksha. I'm just trying to show you things. This is not something I made up. This is the rabbanut, and they tell you that. The truth is it says it, and it's highlighted. Why you set up a system that's destined to fail, I don't understand, because none of the stores have a mashgiach tmidi. There's not hashkachat smudah, but they do. So, according to the Rabbanut Yerushalayim, if you buy, like, in a Rabbanut Yerushalayim store, and you buy chopped meat from one of these guys, and he puts it in the bag while you're there, in essence, you're buying meat without hashkachat, they're not responsible. Yeah. In Yechiel Spear's opinion, based on visiting 80 some odd stores in Beit Shemesh over 2 years, you know, a few rounds, and based on really pounding the pavement in Yerushalayim. And again, like this cafe Rimon I started with, the Mashgiach there in the Chov Lunz is gewaldig, he's a wonderful guy. He's there, he checks, he's bodek, he's washing, he's cleaning. They have vegetable cleaning solutions, they have sinks just to wash the stuff. There's Mashgichim that do a good job, and unfortunately the other guys take them down. I'll give you a simple formula, okay? Forget about my madness, and I can have my own standard. You can say I'm subjective, it's not a fair opinion, you shouldn't. Like one Rav said to me, I have to ask Mechila for being Mashmitz Talmidei Chachamim when you talk about a heksher that's no good. To which I replied, I'll do that when I want him, ask Mechila to the people for feeding them things they shouldn't be eating. So we'll both go to the Mechila line together. Okay, when you... What was I going to say? Like I said, Beit Shemesh is a good heksher. It does what it says it's going to do. Look, in most cases, first of all, Beit Shemesh, they'll also insist that the store has a badatz heksher with it for different reasons. It facilitates their job. but it also gets them the way they want to be. You remember, in the Beit Shemesh, for example, according to the chief rabbi of Israel, this again, this is the Rabbanut Reishit protocol, not my thing. Rabbanut Mahadrin is Bishul Akum Mesfardim. We're not getting into a big deal what that's about. That's one of the classes that means the Mashkiach, or a Jew, had to have taken an active role in the cooking. It's not enough like for an Ashkenazi where he just lit the gas and that's it. Okay? There's a significant difference. Rabbi Shlozberg, who's the Rav Posig, Rabbi Yerushalayim, says, we don't promise Sfardim have Bishul Yisrael, because I went to him, I checked a lot of places, I asked the Mashkichim, is this Bishul Yisrael for Sfardim? They said, no. One after the other, I went to Malcolm Wall, no. Baruch Hashem, the Mashkichim were honest, they said, I don't want the Achlayas, they said, the whole kitchen's full of Goyim, I'm one guy, sometimes you have to go to the Shevetim, sometimes you have to daven Mincha, sometimes you need to turn around and breathe, there's nothing here but Goyim, how can it be Bishul Yisrael for Sfardim? You go to the Rabbanut and say, but I don't understand. Af pam lo eftachnu l'tzibur sh'Rabbanut Mahadrin z'bishul Yisrael Sfardim. You go here to Rav Swiss's, ma pitom. It has to be. There's no breva, in breva. So that's the difference. That's one of the differences. Understand? So, and you see when you speak to a guy, when he has a handle on what's going on around him, I ask him about a store. Look what goes on here in Pesach, that the Rabbanut of Beit Shemesh closed 80-something stores, 100 stores for Pesach. He decided that since there's no batel b'shishim during the year, like you have during the year, but Pesach is also b'mashahu, and he didn't want the achlayas to start kashering and with this whole baloney. You need bayomah. You have to wait a day. You should wait 24 hours before you kasher. Then you're fighting the stores. Mapitom, I'm going to sit there for 24 hours not do any business. Then you're going to first come in and kasher. And he just realized it's too much responsibility. It cannot be done properly. So he went around to all the stores and said, Beit Shemesh stores are closing for Pesach. And there was a few of the bigger places that argued. And he said, you can do whatever you want, but understand, if you open Pesach, Yisruchag, you're not getting a Tudat Kashrut anymore. It ends. The rest of the year, you'll be treif. And he closed down the entire Beit Shemesh ready for 2 or 3 years. That's a tremendous thing. So those of you that want to go for a cup of coffee, it's a bummer. But he cares about Kashrut. And that's the same as, I don't know, Tzvad is wonderful Kashrut. You go to Chalon is wonderful Kashrut. There are places the Rabbanut does a nice job. And me personally, it doesn't matter if I eat in the place or not, but it's not fair. Lashmitz, they always say Rabbanut stinks, Rabbanut this, Rabbanut that. There are places like Yerushalayim, unfortunately, give the Rabbanut a bad name. Dafki Yerushalayim, the capital of Am Yisrael, but that's what it is. Maybe it's because they haven't been chief rabbis for over a decade. I don't know. Because I know when we made Aliyah 30 years ago, the most Haredi of the Haredim ate Rabbanut Mahadrin. Things changed. It's not the same level it once was. I maintain Adarab, I maintain. To an extent, I mean, the Eidah Haredi has been around a long time, and I'm saying Begadol, if the Rabbanut would maintain what it once did in certain areas, a lot of these Badatsim wouldn't be around and things would be less complicated. Okay, I have a quote I show in the schools with different audiences when I do a presentation back to this Rabbi Rafi Yochai from the Kashrut Enforcement or Kashrut Floor Division, whichever you prefer. He wrote in Basheva last year, he said, I blame the Tzibur Dati Lumi for destroying the Rabbanut Kashrus. So what's the point? He wrote. He said, you go into restaurants, you sit down, you eat. You don't look for the Tudah, you don't ask for the Mashkiach, you don't ask, you don't care. And as a result, just like Cafe Rimon, the owner woke up one day and said, I'm paying this guy thousands, I'm paying this guy thousands. What for? Throw them all out. And that's it. The law says I have to have Rabbanut. I have Rabbanut. So he went a step up, he took Mahadrin instead of regular, and I'm done. He saves a fortune. And he's right. At the end of the day, the kashrut for most stores is a business decision. No one's going to... If a guy's doing business in Beit Shemesh, not Ramat Beit Shemesh, a guy opens up a store in Beit Shemesh, he's not going to run to get Eidach Reid Hech, he's out of his mind. Just throw money away, what for? And you impose stringencies on yourself. You can only buy meat in a certain place, you can only do this in a certain place, excuse me, why? So if you come down here to Amar Aleph and you open up, you need it, because otherwise no one's going to buy. It's a business decision. So places have realized that it's up to us to start getting it going. So here you have, by the way, the Rabbanut Tudah, and I used the Jerusalem because it made the point. They're telling you that pretty much, oh, I knew what I was going to say before. So the Rabbanut, the regular Rabbanut, according to the chief Rabbanut, says that the Mashkiach has to be in the store at least 3 hours a day. So I know a bunch of Mashkiachim. Even though I'm a wild man, I get along with the Mashkiachim. Some of them cry because they do the best they can. And they're not capable of maintaining the level they'd like. It's just not possible. A guy is in charge of 6 stores, 7 stores. Last week we met a guy, he's in charge of a Rabbanut Mahadrin Basari restaurant, which demands he has to be there a good few hours a day. The minimum is 3 for regular. Mahadrin, he needs to be there more like 5 or 6, and this is also a high-volume kitchen. He has 8 restaurants he watches. So you figure it out. Let's say 3 hours a day. That's 24 hours. Yeah, he's going to do that in a lifetime. You're lucky if you see 24 hours a week. So when I go down to Rabbanut and I said, Chaver, this is not some guy because I'm Haredi, I'm not Haredi, call me whatever you like. I'm not picking, but you set up a system that has to fail. You give a mashgiach 6 doors, it's 18 hours a day. He's never going to do that. You know that. So the Rav is telling me, lo yechol yod. So what do you mean lo yechol yod? I spent weeks, literally weeks, in the Tachna Mekazit. People that know me know I spent weeks. Couldn't drink any more coffee. How much coffee can you drink? You sit there for hours pumping yourself with coffee. And I go from store to store, for mashgiach. I only took the Rabbanut Mahadran places. In the food court. Where's the mashgiach? Where's the mashgiach? Upstairs, downstairs, there's one downstairs, there's one on the other side. So I called about 10 places. I'll tell you, in a week, one place, in an entire week, I never met a mashgiach once. So what can you say? You can tell me whatever you like, but I see the deal. You know, you go next door to Center One, the mashgiach lives there. Like I said, if you know the mashgiach's good, and then you know the street is good, whatever they use, that meets you, commensurate with whatever you need, because it's the head, enjoy it. In Baruch Hashem, like I said, in Beit Shemesh, it's a different picture of Mugami. Beit Shemesh, in my mind, is what the Rabbanut should be. And when I speak, I often quote it because it's a wonderful thing. And I think, even if it's Tzibur says, I don't eat Rabbanut because I don't want to eat their Shechita for whatever the reason, at the end of this, you may decide yes or no. That's not for me. I don't really care. I don't get percentage from anyone. But the idea is to appreciate when it's done correctly. And this is one of the places it's done correctly. Does it mean nothing happens? No. If you read the Kashrut guide, and if you didn't, you can buy it. I don't get commission on that either. And the Shul doesn't make anything on it either. A place like Machsanei, what's it called? Kemat Chinam or something like that, the supermarket in the big center. So I wrote a long interview in Mashgiach. We redid it a few times. The guy spent an enormous amount of time with me. The guy's a marvelous person, a Yiras Shemayim. You can tell that when you speak to him for 10 minutes. And he's crying. He says, please, write. I said, you're crazy. You could get fired for this. Write. We did. I wrote. It's in Hebrew and English. You can hear him shawing in two languages. He's there 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. He doesn't stop running. He runs and runs and runs and runs. 4 o'clock he leaves. The store closes at 11. The guy in charge of the meat department is a goy. The guy in charge of the dairy department, a goy. So what's going on between 4 and 11? What about Simon Kuf Yud Ches, Basar Shnis Alemer Ayin? No one's watching the meat, literally. And he shows me, Romeli, he comes in the morning, he sees pieces of meat that have the plumb, it's fine, but what when you cut it in half, and you Dafka wanted the... You know, the first cut that had the plumber, so the second cut has nothing left. Tomorrow, no one really should be buying that meat. They shouldn't be selling it, but they are. And he's saying, please write it. So I said, why doesn't the Rabbanut? And the Rabbanut explained, I don't really get it, but they have to give a hechsher, and they tried their best, and they can't get more mashgichim in the stores. Mamish fights tooth and nail to nothing. They don't want to spend a dime for kashrus. I showed pictures. There's a picture, I think, in the guard as well, showing you how the meat table is right next to the dairy slicer, and there's no hafadah between them, all kinds of really basic things. So the mashgiach said, please, tell your tzibur, come in and start yelling, go over to the guy, where's the manager? I'm not buying meat here, what's going on? Where's the plumber? Where's anything? So this is, again, you buy there, you don't buy there. The average person says, I'm not buying here, and they just leave. They don't make any noise about it. I don't mean start... You know, do a whole scene so they can write about some more Haredi madness in the press. That's not the goal. The goal is to be respectful, but the goal is by explaining to people. You know, we've had places where I've gotten women to go into a store, 6 or 8. You don't need 1,000, but if you do it, if you time it well, and you have 6, 7 women going into a store 15, 20 minutes apart, no matter how busy the manager is, the person's going to remember this. And they say, we're sorry, we can't buy here anymore because you don't have this hechsher. We're sorry, we can't buy anymore. Because you don't have any fum guy behind the counter and there's no mashgiach. We can't buy you anymore. And you just, every 20 minutes, very nicely, I just want to let you know, maybe you'll change it. And they changed. Because the guy got the message. The guy needs to do business. So, is it perfect? No. And is all the badats are perfect? No. But you got to know what the reality is. Okay. This we discussed about the 42 days old, 7 weeks. We'll leave it like that, for example. Okay. I would like to ask, since I cleared this before, that's good, and I don't know if he'll be here again next week, so I'm going to chop Rabbi Dr. Eli Berman, who I'm abusing my friendship with. This is a gentleman who is by far more an expert than have anything to do with shots, veterinary medicine, who's also a veterinarian who deals with the chicken industry for as long as I know him, and probably quite a bit before that. If you wouldn't mind giving the Tzibo a little bit of a rundown what's involved with the shots and things like this. Okay?
I won't let you get out that easy.
Okay, I wasn't either.
I'll make it very quick because I can talk about it.
Microphone.
Basically, all the chickens in Israel are given injections. All of them. Let's not say that. All chickens in Israel should be given injections. Nearly all the hashkachot permit giving injections to chickens. Some of them send mashgichim at the time the chickens are injected, some don't. There's one rabbanut that claims the chickens are not injected. Okay, and there is one that claims they're not injected. I can tell you either the birds aren't injected, or they're injected without hashkacha, or they're injected on Shabbat or Yom Tov so that the mashgiach can't see that they're injecting them when they say they're not injecting them. Okay, I don't know if you follow me. There's one specific rabbanut demands they don't inject the chickens. I work for the veterinary services and we demand they do inject the chickens. So we send our inspectors and they send their inspectors. To avoid their inspectors, they started injecting them on Shabbat and Yom Tov so that they won't catch them injecting when they're not supposed to. So basically we should assume that all chickens are injected. Okay? Turkeys also, all of them are injected. I can go into where they're injected. Different rabbaniot demand they inject in different places. There are three things that can cause trefot from injections. Either you can hit the tzomet gidim, you can hit the esophagus, the veshet, or you can go into the body cavity and hit the intestines. And those are the three things that the different rabbanut worry about, where to inject them. As a result, each rabbanut asks the man to be injected in a different place. If there are any questions, I can go on.
What are you injecting them with?
Newcastle vaccine. No. It's a vaccine. Vaccines aren't antibiotics. Vaccines prevent disease. There's a certain disease of chickens called Newcastle, and they inject them to prevent the disease.
Okay, why not inject it in the right place?
What's the right place?
Where it won't break the...
Well, but as I'm saying, each rabbanut thinks the right place is a different place. Okay, birds are injected very rapidly. Okay? Yechiel wrote in his thing that there's some houses have up to 80,000 chickens. You're an old-fashioned. Chicken farms today are somewhere between 20,000 and 300,000 chickens in a farm. And they have to inject all 300,000 chickens in a day. Okay, so they're injecting birds very quickly. One person can inject between 2,000 and 3,000 chickens an hour. Okay, so... Yes. Yes. One rabbanut, only one rabbanut. I don't want to say which. One rabbanut, one hashkacha claims that their chickens are not injected. Oh no, it is possible. We catch people who don't inject, yes. Yes, yes.
For health reasons.
For health reasons, yes. What? Organic chickens are also injected.
What other possible injections are there that we should be aware of in the mass production?
Chickens are rarely injected with antibiotics also, but it's quite rare. Okay, but they can be injected with antibiotics. What?
Other vaccines that are given?
There used to be a vaccine given a day of age in the hatcheries, which is very, very rare today. It used to be a big problem with kashrut, and today it's not done. Any other injections given to chickens? I'm talking about chickens, broiler chickens, chickens you eat. Not the egg layers, it's a whole different story. No, rarely they give antibiotics and that's it.
What are the chances of the injections?
Less than 1% for sure. I would probably say less than 1 in 1,000. Okay. No chicken has been injected with hormone for at least 50 years anywhere in the world. Or been fed hormones for at least 50 years anywhere in the world. Ask the rabbis that question.
I don't know what to ask, but the slideshow right there says that they are injected with glucose.
I mean, there are a few things that I can say absolutely, but absolutely I can say There is no hormone on the market anywhere in the world for chickens. There are for cattle, by the way. Cattle do get hormones. Chickens are not given any hormones at all. And they haven't been done for 50 years. Absolutely, I can say that. Okay.
So I think if you grasp it from Dr. Berman's, this is from decades of experience in the field, like you said, ask the rabbis. The Rabbanim, I'm not going to have any argument. The Rabbanim say that many of them, but the Badatzim say you have to have a hashkacha for the injections. On the other hand, they say, like Rabbi Zeritsky, again, I'll use him, he'll say, if you poke a trachea of a bird that age, it's going to die. It's not going to make shkita anyway. So even if it's in that, below the milta matzoi that you trafed it up, you're not going to have to worry about it because it's a mute point. You won't be alive for shkita. But nonetheless, like there is a company like Chad V'Chalak, for example, that does that's a fellow, I think, I don't remember his name, it's not important. He found his niche that he provides supervision for the injection phase of the chickens. That he takes achlayas, the badatzim trust him, and they get their injections, and then he says that this batch is okay. That's what they do. Okay? Let's see, we're going with this and this together. This is a hard phase. We did this orally. Did this as well. These are what the boxes look like. I try to put some pictures in too, because you hear terms, you hear things. This is the way the chickens are delivered on the trucks. This is the way they transport. If you've ever done kaporas, you see them also on the streets this way. I'm not getting into the humanistic issues and what's right and what's wrong. There's a lot of things not right about a lot of industries. We're here to discuss the kashas end. But this is the way the birds are transported. Okay. Okay. What? Like I said, not going there. The next thing we will talk about is the knife. And the knife is basically, it's one of the biggies. Anyone that studies Shechita, it's been a shochet, they know it's about a pagum. There's different kinds. We're not here to even attempt to go into the sugyas of Yehudah. But the point is, the knife has to be what it has to be, conforming with halacha. It has to be burr-free, pogum-free, it has to be clear, sharp a certain way, and has to conform with what the standard is. I don't think there's more or less a halachic difference between any of the rabbanim what a knife should be. Everyone knows what a shechita knife is supposed to look like, and I don't think anybody's arguing about it, okay? Okay, this will leave for you when you... What? That's correct. I'm talking about... All right, we'll start... Everyone agrees when you start, the knife should look a certain way. Correct. Rabbi David Stein spoke. He was head of like chicken slaughter for Dats Mahadran, Rabbi Rubin, for quite a few years. He has a lot of experience. But no one's arguing about, you can say the knife could be almost sharp, but have a, no one, not the Rabbi Newton, not anyone, and anyone saying otherwise, I think he's just talking stam. Okay? These are some of the things that some of the, and again, some may be funny to you, some may be serious, but when it comes to hiring the shochet, what they do, these are some of the different things they will look for. I will tell you, for example, I was at one shechita house months and months ago, and they had a hafskat chashmal. For me, that wasn't enjoyable, it was wasting time. I wanted to see what I wanted to see, but at the end of the day, what really turned out to be a nice thing for me is I watched this seven of about 10, 12 guys. The electric was out, not just in the plant, the whole area. So they had about an hour and 20 minutes of nothing to do. So to me, it showed me the level of the shochet. No one was outside hanging out, smoking, schmoozing. One guy took a gemara, another one took a shulchan aruch. They all sat down, they were learning. That's the kind of person you hope the shochet is. A lot of the treifas in shechita, which you learn the other day, everyone knows that a lot of it is in the hands of the shochet. You know, if it's domes, if it's hashayah, the things that go on that no one can know but the shochet. You can't sit there and look, ooh, you know, you went back and forth with the knife. Ooh, you pushed the knife too hard, and you didn't cut with the blade. You can't know these things. So you're hoping to have a shochet that's a Yir Shemayim, and if he feels that something was wrong, you will step forward and throw the bird away. It's a lot of pressure. Remember, if the guy had a bad day, let's say, and he messed up a bunch of chickens, and the guy watching the shechita starts seeing chickens being thrown into the dud box, that's a pun, I guess. You know, they'll say, this is very nice, I'm sorry you had an off day, but tomorrow don't bother coming, you're costing us a fortune, we need the chickens. Remember, the chicken rate, as it says on the sheet, the chicken rate can be anywhere from 14 to 18. From 18 to 20, and the Vedatsim 8 to 12, I've seen higher than that too. I've seen 13, 14 as well. But the bottom line is there are differences between the Rabbaniyot Klal. I'm trying to give general terms. I'm trying to be as accurate as I can. I've seen a lot of Mashchitot. I've seen a lot of slaughterhouses. You know, the Eidah Chavedis at the slow end, Rabbaniyot at the higher end. Some of the Vedatsim are faster, some are slower. The experts, the Rabbanim who really know, they say, and to me that makes the most sense from the limited knowledge and seeing what I've seen over the years. A good shochet, some guy could be capable to do 10 a minute, some could do 14 a minute, and there's no difference in the quality of his shechita whatsoever. He has that ability, that's all. So the speed alone is not the decisive factor. I mean, we say speed because, and it sounds, people go, my gosh, 18 a minute, how can you do 18 a minute? Lamaisa, I wonder how you can do 12 a minute. I'm watching. It's an amazing thing when you watch it. You know, it's several seconds, the bird is handed to a shochet, slit, dumped into the bucket, next. And it never stops. It just goes like this, nonstop, nonstop. You know, and it's, you realize the end of a day in a moderate slaughterhouse, they did 80,000 chickens. It's an amazing thing. Okay, so there is not a lot of room for error because of halacha. And some people will care if the shochet goes to mikvah or not. Just like if some people say that's ridiculous, what's happening to halacha? Everyone according to the minhagim, whatever is important to you. I put these things out not to besmirch the ones who don't and not to put the ones that do on a pedestal, but to show you there are many, many differences, and you have to start understanding what means to you, what's important for you, what isn't. You know, there are some badat shechitas that part of the contract is the shochet goes to mikvah in the morning. Some guys probably go anyway, some don't. It's not an issue for me. You have to just know these things and know what's important. The other hand is you just say, big deal, there's a Rabbi Machshe, he's being, I'm so mech on him, whatever he says is kosher, eat it. That's fine too, but you have to understand what it is they do. Okay, I think there is an importance on page 3, for those that have the sheets. And if you read the top and you read the gray box, all right, as a klal, and I rounded it off just to make the math easier, if the Rabbanut chickens are 14 to 18 to 20 a minute, okay, per shochet that is, okay, so that means in a 15 minute period you could have anywhere between 210 and 270 chickens with shechter. If a badatz does 8 to 12 chickens a minute, in the same 15 minutes you have 120 to 180. So the low end is 120 to 2. Versus 210, and the high end is 180 versus 270. Why is that important? Lamaisa, if you say the guy's good, he knows how to shecht and he can do it faster, that's great. It's important though, for example, when you're standing on a line and they do bedikat sakinim and they find a pogum, they find something wrong with the knife, one particular place, it was not that long ago, the Rav came out and checked, and he very quickly ascertained that this knife, something, it had a nick in it, that Dafko made the shechita questionable. So he right away, it's pretty cool, you hit the switch, the alarm goes off, everything stops, the line stops. Literally it stops. There's three shochtim shechting, and each station is repetitive of the other. There's a goy handing the chicken to the shochet, the chicken, the shochet with the knife, then there's this little thing that turns around where they dump the shecht the chicken into, where the blood drips down into, and it starts its way along the line. There's three of these guys doing it. When he stops, everything stops. So now you have to figure, let's say he's doing 10 a minute, and the last bedika was 15 minutes ago, so it's 10 a minute per shochet, times 15 minutes, times 3, it's 450 chickens. So that means, Lamaisa, if he waited that long, there's now 450 chickens that are questionable. How bad is the knife messed up? Is it really a suffix? Is it warrant a hefsin maruba? Do you really say these chickens could be bad? It's a cost taking 450 chickens off the line, or not? All right. In this case, Sachakol, because they check every draw, it came out between the three shochtim, it was a question of 60 chickens. And the Rav, the Botek Sakinim, because he takes his job seriously, said 60, that's fine. Then they take off another 10 at each end for extra measure, because I don't want to have this on my neshama. So he made them take 80 chickens off the line. And they went in, they counted 80 chickens off the hooks, and they threw them into the barrel that they're not using them. It's not a barrel, it's a ramp, whatever. So that's one of the big areas, and we're going to show you this in the videos as well. This is one of the big areas where you now have a difference. For example, and I wrote that in the gray box, and this is, again, it just pans out the math. It's not that complicated. Some of the Rabbaniyot chickens places I've seen, where I've seen 12, 14 shochtim, it's a big line. Like Dr. Berman said, it's the shechtim. There's mass production. It's not a game. It's not like Europe when someone shechted in the village and you had a question, they went to the Rav, you hung around until you finished Daf Yomi, he checked the chicken, you went home. It doesn't work that way anymore. All right, most of the times if it's Vadai Treif, it's Treif. And if it's a Safek, then they throw it to a different pile. We'll talk about that later. And if it's for sure good, it's used. That's it. It's milliseconds. Decisions are made, and the assembly line has to keep moving. That doesn't stop. Okay. So if you're having 10 shochtim, we'll use 10 times 20. 10 times 20 is 2,000, and they're only 2,000 a minute, and they're only going to check after 10-15 minutes. You're talking about thousands of chickens. All right. No one in their right mind is going to. No one who wants to stay employed the next day in their right mind is going to parcel 4,000 chickens or 3,000 chickens. It's never going to happen. So they're going to start having, then you start coming with the heterum. It's not really a pogrom, it's a bidi eved. We'll change the knife for the next ones, but we can use it for this. And I've seen these things. This is not, and I'm not going to use names because it's not an inyan. The inyan is to understand. The Ha'ayim and Badatzim say our goal is to avoid such a situation by going slower, by having less people shechting simultaneously, and by checking more frequently. So at the worst situation, I'll never be past a place where I have a few hundred chickens that are questionable, and that's the high end. And that's what they do. Like the higher end is the Eid HaChareda, where there's a Bodek Sakinim that hangs around there all the time. Remember, when the Shoftim go out to Shech, let's say they do a 20-minute to a half-an-hour shift, and then they have a 20-minute, depending on each place, 20 minutes to half an hour rest period, where their lives are sharpened, where they do what they have to do, and they relax. It's hard work. That's chickens. Turkeys is a different story. Okay, so some, like the Eder Chavede, for example, has a Bodeg Sakinim that lives on the line. He's constantly checking. The Shochtim, though, when they go out to the line, will have a minimum of 3 knives. And they're changing the knives. They don't check for 15-20 minutes with one line. Not the Rabbanut guy, not anybody. They change the knives. And the Mashketot, the slaughterhouses, also have a knife gemach. Like if he needs another knife, there's always other knives on hand. There's always a Bodeg Sakinim inside an office. There's always someone sharpening knives. You learn when you walk around a slaughterhouse, you look where you're walking, there's always someone carrying a very sharp instrument. There's knives everywhere. But the knives, because it's critical, there's halacha, these aren't chumas, the knives are changed. So now we go back to our graph with the Rabbanut on one side and the Badatz on the other side. The Badatz contention is, the Rabbanut has too many shochtim working simultaneously, shechting too quickly, inspecting the knife too infrequently, and as a result, when a question arises, it's not just possible, but it's likely that the Rav will not have the ability to puzzle the chickens, and they will always look for a heter and come up with a bidi eved psak halacha. The Rabbanut, on the other hand, says, I don't know what you want. These are qualified shochtim. We do bidikot as well. The shochtim change the knives. And if chas v'shalom, something was really treif, we would say it's treif and we would get rid of the chickens. But there are gray areas, and we don't have to sit there looking for ways to puzzle good chickens and to go crazy with it. From what I've seen, yes. If you're sitting there, if you're the guy in charge, all right, and the boss comes out, the plant manager comes out, let's say you have 1,500 chickens sitting there, and now you're going to say yes or no. If it's yes, life goes on as usual. If it's no, we now took 1,500 chickens, the time it took to slaughter them, whatever process went in between, and the actual chicken's value and the cost, and threw them in the garbage. That's a heavy decision. You know, it's the same. It's with everything with Shechita. You go to South America, when the Rosh Tzeved of a Mashkata often has to fight the importer. The importer is looking at the profit margin. He's paying for the shochtim. He's paying for the airfare. He's paying for the hotels. He wants to make money. He's entitled to. But there are times where it could be questionable. And he'll say, if it's questionable, so give it the rule in my favor, not just throwing chickens out. The numbers are that vast, yes. Correct. Correct. So I'm saying this one Badatz I went to, they had 3 guys going and they check every drawer is like 20 chickens, so they'll check more often, they say. I don't know if they always do it. I have learned that to go do inspections at a Mashketa and come out and say things are great is no big kunst. The idea is you have to let them get to know you enough that you can come whenever you like, which I do in certain places. Then you can really see. Or like one Rav who takes me around, he taught me, he said thank you, and then all the guys with the long white coats, like in a hospital, the long white coats, those that are ready, the professors, they're running the show. So after they leave, you go out like you go to the car, then you come back in, use the bathroom, you go back in, you stand there another hour and just hang out in the corner like a dummy. You don't say anything, you watch. But you're counting. Then you really see what speed they really shecht at. You understand? It's no great shakes. Anyone in the army, you know the same thing. You know, Machat comes for Bikoret, he's going to do an inspection, or the Mempeh, whatever it is. So you're shining your shoes and you're getting ready. No one wants to get stuck for Shabbos. Everyone wants to go home. No one wants to hear about it. So everything's perfect. The idea is when he checks, when no one knows he's coming, that's the inyan. So by and large, the numbers are that vast, and there is that you need to have that much Yiras Shamayim, I believe, to be able to make those decisions. And in this case, for example, I would like to believe that I'm not important enough that my presence made any difference there. And when he rang the bell and shook, I mean, he's nice to me, the guy, because we get along. I'm not like Moed Asra of Bayit Vegan, that if I said, whoa, this is a bad place, they're out of business, you know. And they did. They took off the 20 extra, 10 on each side. He wanted to be sure that the chickens in question were apprehended. He got the culprits, and they took 80 chickens off the line. Still a lot. It's 80 chickens. That's the reality, because you can't stop every 2 minutes either. So the Eda Chavede says that what they do is they have the online guy who's always checking. He's just grabbing and checking, and it slows it down. You can't work as quickly. So that's one of the reasons, by the way, and you will see this as we progress. One of the largest reasons for the cost factor of the high-end Badatz chickens versus other chickens is the manpower involved. Just remember, as you will see, now it's a lot is conceptual, but you'll will see it might help. If you have three shochtim, and this is a Badatz operation where they're doing some of the gidim, and they're also doing like a skeletal, they check the integrity of the skeletal system, and they're millisecond inspections. Don't think someone's sitting there like for hours checking the bones to see if there's a fracture. But the point is, everything is repeated by the amount of shochtim. So if there's three or four shochtim, there's three or four some of the gidim guys. And there's other guys, you know, that are checking the other things that they check, where the rabbinate doesn't check. So the manpower demands are higher and higher. The cost obviously is commensurate. If you have another six people working 8 hours a day, someone's paying for it, and it's not the guy that's producing the chickens. Yeah.
They have.
I'll show you tags. It goes in Arabic. They have a black tag in one place that I give you pictures. It's in Arabic and Hebrew. It says treif on it. That's one thing. My thing in life is always looking like for the loopholes and what's been wrong and bad. I've yet to find. And any of the mashgichot, I thought, I haven't found a break in the system. Meaning, once a chicken is determined to be treif, it's marked, it's put in a certain place. I was trying to see how could it work its way back, God forbid, to the kosher line by mistake, not chas v'shalom intentionally. They have that under control, and there is a market for treif chickens as well. I don't know. I don't go into that. What? Okay, so it was a lot. Makes sense. Goyim aren't stupid. Why are they going to pay our price? It's the same in Chutzlaretz. You want to have glot, you want to have this. The goyim take the hindquarters. In North America, the Jews don't eat it. And other things. So you pay for the price. You pay the difference in it. That's all. There's no way around that. Yeah. Because if you have three guys working, and he dumps it in the bucket, when the other side of the bucket, the guy takes it and hangs it on the hook, and the guy next to him hangs it on the same hook, and it's one line. You don't know which chicken was his of the three. Because you don't know which it is, if it's treif. Because first of all, this is easy. First of all, he checks the knife. Now you came home and checked my knife. Right? You have no idea between the last inspection and now when the knife went bad. You have no idea how many chickens were shechted with a porcelain knife. Or a very questionable knife, depending on whatever the mice is. You don't know that. What? There's one, you take the one. But you have no idea how long, that's what I'm saying, so... Again, I'll keep using the Ada as the extreme at that end. They'll say, check it frequently enough that the damage in between knife check and knife check is minimal. And this way I don't have to worry about it. So I got me on 10 chickens, 10 chickens. But it's not 1,000, it's not 100, it's not 2,000. I know what I'm doing. Because once you see a knife that's damaged, you don't know where between the last inspection and this current inspection where it went bad. That's the problem. Yeah. As far as I understand, you can ask Dr. Berman as a shochet as well. Hitting bone and gidin and stuff, it wears it down, no? I've seen some. Okay. Why? Because of the alloy that the blade is made is a much higher. Today, just the materials are better. And if I understand correctly, years ago they had to always decide between chad and chalak, how fine to make it, then it was too prone to injury. But today, with the different alloys, it's not as common. Nachon. But I don't know. The answer is I don't know. I don't check. I can't tell you. Okay, here I'll just give you a little video for those that don't want to watch, don't watch. For those that want to get an idea, I took a little short video snip of Turkish chita only because it's a much slower process. A simple reason: look at the size of the bird. You can't just take it in one hand. Shochet holds it. You know, he does the simanim, snip 3 seconds, puts it down. This bird, with all its body weight, weighs a bit. You know, 35 plus kilo perhaps. Some of them, they're large, and you'll see the shochet doesn't hold the bird. He steadies the head and neck, but the person has to hold the bird for him. You can't do everything at once. I think how I start this, if I can get it right. Not wrong. All right, we'll try again. Try again. I know it works. Just to give you an idea, you keep saying speed, or as it looks, just to give you an idea. Back here, that's the line. Obviously moving much slower. This is turkey, not chicken. You can see how pleased they were that I was standing there videoing them. Can't say I blame them. Okay, to the right of the shulchan, he also has running water there where he's constantly rinsing his knife in between, you know, in between and getting any dirt, all the different things that have to do with halacha and the clean area and the feathers and all the other issues that we're not learning about. That's for those that are shulchan or learning hilchos shechita, not for this forum. But the point being, that gives you an idea what the shechita looks like for turkey. All right, this, I ran around a lot, and this is what I found to be factual, and trying to be fair and put the most in I can, okay? Trying to give you again, here is to show you differences. If it looks one-sided, it's only because these are what the facts are, I don't make it up, okay? The Badatsim have a shorter shift in theory. At least this is what they all tell me. I have to admit, I don't stay there all day watching when guys clocked in and out, and also not with the Rabbanut, but I'm told that this is the Mitziyut based on about a half a dozen places. Okay? The speed of the Shechita, how long you work and how long you rest. There's also an Inyan Shochtim explained to me that after you shecht a while, your hand does get tired, you know, and you don't have the same feel that you might have had the beginning of the shift till after the shift, so they need the breaks. It's not because, well, the Atzlanim, they need to take breaks every 20 minutes. I work a full day. What's this about? There's a reason for it. Okay, the knives inspections, how often they're done. Again, now we understand that the more frequent they're checked, the less amount of chickens we could have being questionable as far as kashrut. And some of the badatsim, not all, bodek sakinim may be on the floor. Some I've seen do, some don't. Like I said, just like the badatsim and the rabbaniyot, there's different levels. And but this is, I'm trying to do things. If everything was the same, even among the badatsim, or if everything was the same among the rabbaniyot, so this would be very easy. You take Excel and you make a spreadsheet. Who does someone I get him? Who does this? Who does that? Who does that? And you go check, yes, no, like the car comparison. The end, you write what color fuel, you know, fuel mileage it is, and that's the end of it. But it doesn't work that way. And that's why it gets very difficult. Like some of the Badatsim will insist on cutting off that last tip of the wing because that's where there's coagulated blood. Others say you only cut off half. Some cut off the tush, some say you don't have to. So there's so many different things that some do and some don't do. It's difficult. It's like people say, what's the best hatch? I guess whichever one you eat is the best one. I don't know. That's trying to be honest. And again, I think, see, I'm not as bold with that stuff. There are a bunch of them who I've heard speak that are really shochtim, that are in the field for decades, that will get up and say certain brands of treif. I won't go there, but that's their right to say it, and they can defend themselves. I'm not going there. But I think just from, this is really what you saw tonight so far as an introduction. I think you can already see from an introduction there's vast differences between the different shechitas. Again, it may not necessarily be something you think is necessary, and if that's the case, so now you can say, I know there's differences, who cares? Other people will say, wow, I'm glad I know that. Yeah. What? All of Rabbanut is Mahadrim, there's no Rabbanut plain. Rabbanut, Chief Rabbanut said all this, that's what I said in the beginning, we didn't catch it. All the Rabbanut chickens are Mahadrim, and all the Badatsim will tell you all the chickens are Glot. What does it mean? It means each one took a word to instill confidence in the consumer public to say this is the level we're at. The Rabbanut, I don't remember when they did it, but I know in the last few years, they've decided to say that everything is glatten. There's no better or worse than the Badat saying theirs. I mean, the Mahadran is no better or worse than the Badat saying theirs is glatten. When you see Rav Orbach and you see Rav Shlush, they're all Mahadran as far as the chief rabbin is concerned. Like? According to the chief rabbin, all the chief rabbin Yishalayim is Mahadran. All the rabbin chitin in chicken, right, chicken chita. You're right, thank you. According to the chief rabbin of Israel, all the chita that has Ashkalka from the local rabbinate, whatever city it may be, is a Mahadran Shechita. It doesn't matter. It's a play on words, because before it was Mahadran, nothing was different. And the Badatsim, before they were Glat, nothing was different. Everyone, I remember I said the buzzwords. Everyone's tacking words on to make it sound, to instill confidence in the consumer. Nothing changed. L'tov v'l'ra. What makes a Mahadran? There's not a halachic definition for it. There's not even a layperson definition for it. Each one gets to decide on their own. You can go out tomorrow and make sandwiches and say they're Mahadran, and no one can do a thing about it. You decided they're Mahadran, whatever you call Mahadran. There's no term for it. There's no sefer of Hilchos Mahadran from the Rabbanut even to say this is what it is. This is the Shechita. The Shechita is whatever, how they define Halacha, and the Badatzim, they define each one with their Rav Posek. Everyone decides the Kulas and Chumras and what works. But the Mahadran is just the term they use. And so is the glot. Like we said in the beginning, Mahadran and Menahadran is for candles and glot is for cow lungs. You're confusing a restaurant's Tudat Kashrut and Shechita. We're talking about Shechita only. All the chicken shechted under the auspices of the Rabbanut Reshit Yisrael, whether they have a name of Jerusalem Rabbanut Shechita or Haifa or any other city that works for you, they're called Mahadran. Alright, some of them, most prominently Rav Orbach, for whatever reason, it's that they don't call it Rabbanut Tveri, they call it Rav Orbach. He's not the Rav of Tveri either, it's the Av Beis Din. But he's a walking Sefer Torah by any measure of the word, that's for sure. And it doesn't mean some eat this drink and some don't. You know, as we get along into it, I will explain what I feel is a controversy dafka about Rav Orbach, because at least I can tell you, I remember years ago, we'll use the words again, the Haredi community ate Rav Orbach today, it's fallen out of favor in many areas. The question is why. It's the same Rabbi Orbach. And it is. He's a little older, but it's the same place. So I will explain it to the best of my ability, how it was explained to me and how I've seen and what I understand, and do with it as you please. Any other questions for the end of part one? It's supposed to end around 10. There you go. End of part one. Yeah. Right. That's true, that's what he said. I've asked a lot of Abunim over the year if that's true, and everyone concurred, although a bunch told me that's in reference to the Badatz and not the Rabbanut. I'm telling you what they tell me. Look, in America, it's a different thing also. Like here, the Rabbanut will not permit places in America where the chicken is shechted, where the shulch is not holding it. That's a non-starter here, not for the Rabbanut, not for the Badatz. They won't let you even start with that. They feel the shulch has to, even if it's for 3 seconds, he still has the bird in his hand 3 seconds. He feels it. He knows what he's doing. He needs simanim that is shochet. You do daf yomi, so if he wants to finish chulin, you know, you need certain simanei kashas, simanei shchit. He has to know he did the veshet, and he has to know what he did. And the kanei and the veshet. He has to know what you're shachting. You're not just stam. So they feel that, by and large, I mean, the American shchita is a non-starter for the people here. I don't know enough about anything going on in the States to even say that's what Rabbi Stein said. I don't know. Others say it as well. It's not unique to him. But I have never seen... I saw Shechita in America 32 years ago. I don't think that counts for anything today. You know, it's been a few years. If you have any questions on tonight, I would say please prepare them. You can email them. Maybe I'll make a sheet. And we'll come with the questions, try to answer them. My goal here is... If it's boring, I apologize. I hope not. But the goal is not to run through a lecture, because that's what we always do. And to ask the questions and to go as slow as it takes. I'll keep coming back, because the idea is to understand it and to really get it clear, and then make a decision based on what you're knowing, and not just to say, wow, it was a great lecture, and you remember some of the stuff from Upstart. I remember stuff. You had Rabbi Kuba, you had Rabbi Bobo. Baruch Hashem, last year we brought a cast of stars, really, mumchim in the field. You see, he stuck with me. But no, I mean it. These are people that the whole life is kosher. Whether it was Tanuva, we had last year, Rabbi Tanuva and Rabbi Schutz, who worked for Rav Landau for 25 years, and you had the Shatness, Rav Gerwitz. It was a pretty good year. But the idea is to get it down, to really understand it, to ask the questions. If I don't know the answer, I'll tell you, I don't know it. But it is important to understand it once and for all and make a decision what people are doing. Like in a neighborhood like this, I see the list and I see, I get a lot of emails just from this small community like, can I eat Rav Orbach? I said, yeah, open your mouth and eat it. And it's not for me to tell you. It's not for me to tell you. It's not. It's poshut not. And you can stay here with me for 6 months. I'm still not going to tell you what to eat or not. You have a Rav, and it may be the Moed Asim Shul, it may be another Shul. But it's not for me to ask. I hope at least maybe if you get some of the information, you'll say, wow, I didn't know that. Let me ask my rabbi and see, well, how come he said this and said that? If this is the case, so why shouldn't I eat this or that? You know what I'm saying? That's fine too. It's fair. Rabbanim, not every Rav either is in the loop. That I know for sure. Just like not every doctor can know everything about every field of medicine. You know, you become a general physician, then you specialize. And you get yo-yo and you become a Rav and you can paskenis of a het. It doesn't mean that you know the halacha, as I call it, lemaisa in the streets, and you have an idea what's going on. And I know Rabbanim, unfortunately, I challenge them. When they tell the tzibur to eat a particular hachshon, I say, you shouldn't tell them, it's not right for them. And why? And I tell them, I say, how do you know? I said, because I go through the garbage cans at night. And they do. That's how I learn a lot. I learned from Watergate. If you're old enough to remember that, you get it. But if you go to a store's garbage cans, third, fourth, fifth time, you see what they're throwing out, you know what they're using. And when you go during the day and you say, do you use this and this? And they tell you, we only use these hachshirim. And then you repeatedly go through the garbage can, you see they're not being honest with you. That's how you learn. So that's the real deal, you know, and unfortunately it also shows we were mashkichim and not doing the job and they're out to lunch, probably literally. And that's what it is. Okay, next week in Yetz Hashem we will pick up here, this slide, and for those of you who didn't get the sheet and want it, send your email into the shul. It's supposed to send out a digital copy to whoever wants it, I think. From what I've seen, there's a difference of Eda Chavedit and everybody else, period. Eda Chavedit takes it to the level of the slowest, the most cautious about everything. They want to avoid the problems that people have to go. Don't put yourself in a position where you have a question when it's faced with money versus Hashmata versus conscious. Just avoid it. And basic. All those things are part of the Hebrew. They're parts of the Nazis, like so is the Skelos of the Nazis. A lot of them are in the same place, for example. You go to buy, if you buy Beis Yosef, Atala, the company that is Atala, but you bought Atala turkey wings, you bought Kehilo or Fleisch turkey wings, or Kehilo, it's made in the same place, sometimes the same shofar. Some people will say it doesn't matter, and it's true. The Shochim, as you can imagine, the Mashkiach. We're told that these are the parameters for the Shkita today, fast or slow, this or that. So it's not always the same. It's not good either, but there are the Batsim. I'm going in fully. The Batsim do it slower, and they do what they feel is more cautious, cheaper, and try to avoid problems. The Rabbanut is more in the old school, this is where it's done, this is the